We are indeed exiting winter, constant listeners. It's March, almost there to spring. Hang in there. Hey, it's Nick, your host on the podcast known as The Far Middle. Let's get rolling with this week's episode 198, if my count is correct, and I believe that it is. Let's get rolling with our sports dedication for this episode. Now, I've got a dedication that is not timely necessarily from a calendar perspective, because this event pertains to pro football, and we are well past pro football season. But it is applicable to the theme of this episode, which is noting and charting trends that evolve through history. Now, that theme will kick off in a minute or so, but first, the sports dedication, one that shows how much the game of football has changed in a relatively short period of time. So sort of the evolution and the history of the nature of the game of pro football. The game when I was a kid and a young adult, it's basically unrecognizable to the game today. Today, it's all offense and player protection, marketing every day of the week, year round, not back in the late 1970s or even through the 1980s. And I've got a dedication topic to illustrate that point. The year was 1984, early November, Chicago, Soldiers Field, and its hard astroturf. The Bears, as in that intimidating defense of Ditka, a prior Far Middle dedication subject, and Buddy Ryan and his 46 defense that we dedicated a prior episode to as well. They were hosting the franchise that week with the biggest outlaw reputation in league history, the Al Davis Raiders, when they were really the Raiders, both in name and in spirit. Many football experts call this regular season game the most violent game ever played. Now, I don't have a good basis to compare that one to, say, the games of the early NFL before the merger, the days of the Chuck Bednarik's, who was another prior dedication subject on this podcast and such. But for me, it was certainly the most violent game I witnessed as a fan, excluding perhaps only the mid-70s matchups of the Raiders and Steelers. And I was a bit too young to recall those on live TV, but I've seen the tape. They were scary as well, no doubt. Now, I never viewed Chicago's Buddy Ryan's 46 defense as much of a scheme as many, you know, football experts think of it. Instead, to me, I had a much simpler way of looking at it. It was more of an attitude coupled with a simple idea. The idea was that the quarterback is the key to the offense. And even in the 1980s, the trend was already moving toward placing even more importance on the quarterback. Yet defenses, they were always trying to scheme and outsmart all 11 players on offense. And that's a complex task, especially when the offense has the elements of initiative and surprise on its side. Buddy Ryan, he came up with a genius but simple idea with a 46D. Don't beat 11 guys. Instead, just beat, and literally and figuratively beat, one guy on offense, the most important one, the quarterback. Hit him again and again by sending blitzes every play and physically knock him out of the game. Or if he hangs in there, beat him mentally out of the game by scaring him with the constant physical assaults. Now, that was the root, I believe, of the famed Bears defense. Let the offense run or pass for a big play here and there, that's fine, but always, always send maximum pressure to the quarterback. Punish him as harshly as you can. Be brutal. And it was so effective when it first appeared on the scene. If you think I'm exaggerating, or maybe more accurately simplifying this too much, consider what the Bears' safety during that era of their great defense said about their overall strategy. This is from Doug Plank, who again was a safety on that great Bears defense. Here's what he said. What's football? It's chess. Tackle chess. And what's the quarterback? He's the king. Take him out, you win the game. So that was our philosophy. We're going to hit that quarterback 10 times. We do that, he's gone. I hit him late? Fine. Penalize me. Yeah, believe him. That's how the Bears played the game on defense during their heyday in the 1980s. And they had guys like Singletary and Dan Hampton and Dent to impose it. The game before this one with the Raiders, the Bears sacked Archie Manning, Peyton and Eli's dad, 11 times in the game. 11. That's what that defense did going into the next week's game with the Raiders. So here comes the Raiders to the Windy City in early November. And the original AFL adopters of the bully and intimidator model, right, the Raiders, in November. So both teams, they're 7-3. They're off to great starts for the season. Two Hall of Fame running backs on each side, each team. Bears, of course, had Walter Payton. Raiders had Marcus Allen. And by the way, both of those running backs took some vicious hits in the game. The Raiders had a few epic intimidators on defense of their own that they brought to that game. They had Lyle Alzado and Howie Long, and they were the defending Super Bowl champs. So the Raiders were a great team of that era. And both of the teams were looking to bully the bullies and to kill the king, to become the king. That's how sports writer Rich Cohen put it. And the game was indeed brutal. The Raiders kept losing quarterbacks like it was World War I trench warfare. Mark Wilson was knocked out of action not once, but twice in that game. The backup, David Hamm, wasn't only knocked out of the game, but out of football. He never played another down after that game. And how about this? When tapped after the Raiders' second quarterback went down, the Raiders' emergency third-string quarterback for that game was a 35-year-old punter, Ray Guy, a Hall of Famer, by the way. He refused to go in. According to players on the sideline, he said he'd rather retire. Now, again, that's from a Hall of Fame player with the Raiders, for goodness sake. And you know what? I don't blame them. But don't feel bad for the Raiders. You know, they happily meted out their brand of brutality on the Bears' offense. Jim McMahon, the Bears' star quarterback, he suffered a lacerated kidney after a hit from behind in that game. He was urinating blood in the locker room, had to be sent to the hospital. And while he was in the ambulance just before he passed out, he asked what the score was. Well, the Bears won the game 17-6. You can watch the highlights on YouTube. Check those out to see what I'm talking about, what I'm trying to describe. By the way, the announcers were the iconic duo of Hall of Fame player and TV star Merlin Olsen, along with Dick Enberg. That was the old NFL, so to speak, where old wasn't that long ago in the mid-1980s, where a career would end with a dirty hit on any given play and no one would give it much thought, where the most brutal one, where offense was in a drought, where player safety was a joke. It wasn't pretty, but it was certainly real. And it was a world where a Tom Brady or a Lamar Jackson, they wouldn't have a chance of being the greats that we've had the pleasure of seeing them become. Episode 198 is dedicated to what many football fans consider to be the most violent game ever. November 1984 at Soldiers Field, Raiders versus Bears. I mentioned earlier that for this episode, we're going to dive into a series of connections and themes that discuss the great trends in history, specifically trends identified and articulated by one of America's great historians and authors, someone I've long admired and who I've been an avid reader of with respect to his work. His name is Daniel Joseph Boorstin, and he dominated the field of American historians and historical institutions throughout his long and storied career. His life spanned nearly a century and almost all of the 20th century, being born in 1914 and living until 2004. He was an American historian at the University of Chicago, wrote on a lot of topics in American and world history. His books are rich, they're entertaining, they are thought-provoking, and they're the types of books where you need to be focused and paying attention as you read them because there's just a trove of great insight, sentence by sentence. But they're also ones that are so entertaining and thought-provoking that they sort of keep you focused and on point. It's not a tough thing to stay focused reading some of his work. And he wasn't just an academic and an author. He was also appointed the 12th Librarian of the United States Congress in 1975. He served until 1987 across, I believe, three presidents. He was instrumental in the creation of the Center for the Book at the Library of Congress. He ran a Smithsonian Museum, and he won a Pulitzer Prize. So, you know, his professional career resume casts a very wide, deep, and impressive shadow. And his personal journey was also quite interesting. He was a member of the Communist Party when he was young, until he ends up repudiating his membership once he matured and wised up. Boorstin became a political conservative, a prominent architect of what became known as consensus history. So he argued that ideology and propaganda, political theory, those things are somewhat foreign to America. He was a founding and leading member of historians who had similar views of what became known as the consensus school, the core belief being the unity of the American people and one that downplayed class and social conflict. Boorstin especially praised inventors and entrepreneurs as central to the American success story. Yeah, he was a fan of what we'd call the doers, on the far middle. He minimized the role of pure thinkers while emphasizing the importance of practical problem solvers. So he's an interesting guy in the context of where America sits, especially in 2025. His views that consensus history, school of the American identity, and holding doers, creators, inventors up as the ideals in society, yeah, they fell out of favor the past few decades as the left rolled through academia and media and the government bureaucracy and much of political leadership. But the man, his teachings and his books and that consensus school remained as relevant as ever, even if they fell conveniently out of favor. And now we're seeing a bit of a resurgence in those things, making a discussion of some of Boorstin's thoughts and writings quite timely. So let's go. Let's take a closer look at some of those gems, shall we? One of Boorstin's common themes across his writings was differentiating and contrasting two groups of individuals that he thought very highly of, what he called creators and then discoverers. Creators included individuals such as artists and musicians, and he noted that in the culture of creation, there's no such thing as a correct or incorrect approach or answer. That in the long run, one doesn't focus on measuring progress. Progress is largely irrelevant with the creator class. Think of art. With works of art, you know, there's no linear direction. Instead, each additional incremental work of art is free to go in any direction and in all directions relative to its immediate predecessors. And even though one artist might be inspired by another, the work of the new artist, the inspired work, so to speak, it's not just a simple translation as much as it is a transformation of the prior work. Now, discovery is a little bit different. Discovery is what individuals have found out to be true within the same environment. There is a constant line as more is discovered, and there's an incremental path of additional discovery. So when someone discovers something new, they are basically confirming what is already reality, whereas creation results in something new being added to the world. The culture of discovery, and that was one that involved what Boorstin referenced as the spirit of quest, where the participants were all aiming for the same objective. It might be to map the world or to develop a more effective method of sailing, but the individuals in the discoverer class were directly or indirectly collaborating and sharing cumulative learned knowledge, whether they desired to or admitted it or not. Very different from the creator class that consisted in many instances of complete independent individuals from one another. Discoverers, they try to conform to the same path or approach to incrementally move the ball forward, where creators, they're a bit more random and independent in approach and style. So think about the discoverer Columbus or those that followed him and how they all utilized technologies and processes that were developed by individuals, many instances that they never met, but that were nevertheless necessary for them to incrementally achieve their goal as well as the goal on behalf of mankind. Now, that's obviously been the story with scientific discovery, especially. You don't see that in the culture of creation, and the individual plays a very different role as a creator versus a discoverer, and it yields some interesting irony when you compare those different roles. The discoverer is dependent upon collaboration from others, as I said, but the legacy of being noted in history for a discovery typically goes to an individual, despite the group effort. Great discoveries are a team product, but again, there's great exclusivity and buzz about who gets to become noted as the first. That's why we talk about Columbus, but not as much about all the prior discoverers who innovated technologies and advanced knowledge to help put him in a position to reach the new world. Discovery is a history of first, with first often being determined by factors beyond who was actually first. To double the irony, consider that the culture of creation doesn't offer that type of exclusivity to an artist, but it celebrates those who are unique and original. But uniqueness, that's hardly ever truly the case when it comes to creators. Consider the sort of arena of music. Led Zeppelin, the hard rock band. Led Zeppelin sounded unique if your point of reference was a decade or two. But if your span of musical knowledge went beyond that, Led Zeppelin sounded an awful lot like the great Delta bluesman who came well before them. Zeppelin just added distortion to the guitar. You see, the creators get grouped into schools. Just like Boorstin, as a historian, was a founding father of that consensus school of American history that I mentioned. So you've got the Impressionists or the Da Vinci style or school when it comes to art. You've got the same thing with genres of music, such as jazz or rock. Those things ironically diminish the individual artist or creator, even though they are undeniably individually unique. Whereas the discoverer, who represents nothing more than the net incremental step or the next incremental step of cumulative human effort, they get exclusivity when that incremental step is significant and timed at the right moment. That's why there's no Galileo school of discoverers. There's just Galileo. Discoverers get the aura of fame by being first, but then they're almost certain to be displaced with the next discoverer to come down the line in their field. Creators, however, they enjoy their celebrity status once and if obtained, sometimes indefinitely. Let's make a connection to where Boorstin contrasted another pairing in his writings. That's of the adventurer or explorer and the artisan or inventor. He proposed that it was an unappreciated but very impactful revolution that occurred starting sometime around the Industrial Revolution, whereby that discoverer and the inventor, they assimilated into a single community of achieving individuals, to the point where the lines between discoverer and inventor have blurred to beyond there being much of a difference. To a large extent, that partnership is an unofficial and often involuntary one. It's brought together by variables outside the control of the individual inventor or discoverer. Inventors now achieve out in the world beyond the lab, while discoverers, they've gone from the four corners of the earth into the lab to achieve. And perhaps the crucial recognition of this merger was the creation of the term scientist, which came to be around the start of the 18th century. It's a new term, relatively speaking. The first recorded reference to scientist was in 1840. There was an English philosopher and mathematician, William Werrell, who stated that there was a need for a name to describe a cultivator of science in general, and he coined the term scientist. Now, the creation of the printing press, or perhaps I should say invention, that was the key tool that was used to unite inventor and discoverer. Each individual, they now had the ability to inherit all of their predecessors' legacies of discoveries and inventions, putting the individual as next person up in a better position to take that next incremental step. Inventors were then able to bring innovation across three key areas. You got new materials, new sources of energy, and new instruments for sharing experiences, such as the printing press. And of those three, Boorstin, he was always one to point out that the most unsung was innovations in the areas of mining and metallurgy, coal mining, steelmaking, two key examples that come to mind, by the way, both near and dear to the legacy of Appalachia, Western Pennsylvania, and Pittsburgh, my home regions and town. More recent examples, of course, would be things like plastics, polymers. Some of Boorstin's most intriguing writing comes when he chooses topics that converge technological invention with political history. We can make the connection from that technology of printing that I just mentioned to the United States Constitution. Now, the U.S. Constitution, it's the oldest written constitution still in use. Boorstin astutely observes that a more precise definition would be calling it the first printed constitution. Not written, but printed constitution. And if it's the first printed constitution and it's still in use, that logically makes it the oldest printed constitution from which a nation still operates from. Many of the founding fathers were what were back then called men of letters. They had access to printed materials such as books. The Constitutional Convention selected a printing firm. It was the same firm used when drafting the Articles of Confederation. And for this printing firm, when it came to the Constitutional Convention, secrecy was an absolute must. Copies of each iteration of the draft constitution, they would need to be printed and provided to the convention attendees while maintaining absolute secrecy. You didn't want any leaks of drafts of the constitution. And fortunately, the printing firm lived up to its responsibility of secrecy. Printed copies of the current draft of the constitution that would reflect the latest revisions, they were regularly supplied to the members by that printing firm. By the way, the name of the firm was Dunlap and Claypool. And the frequency of these updated drafts that were printed of the Constitution, they were about one per month during that summer in, 1787 in Philadelphia. Then in September of that year, that Constitution was finalized and 500 copies of the final document They were ordered, printed to be dispensed to the public. So the work process flow for coming up with what became our Constitution was to debate changes within the convention using printed versions of the prior draft as the starting point or the foundation. And at the end of that process, when a final constitution was agreed to, the work was finally reduced to a formal writing. But what was interesting was the creation of our constitution, it sort of made the final agreed to version being reduced to a writing sort of obsolete or necessary. All that needed to happen was to print that final version. What Boorstin points out is that without a printed draft serving as the basis for debate that day, that week, that month, and as a basis for discussion as the Constitution wording was evolving, there would be no practical way for 55 delegates at that convention to debate and agree on specific wording and to keep everything straight in their own individual minds. No one could keep the same version of where the consensus was at that moment across those 55 delegates to get to a final version reduced to writing. As Boorstin put it, without the printed draft copies, the constitutional delegates would have been lost at sea. Boorstin, throughout his career, also made a point to emphasize the importance of byproducts, or what today we would refer to perhaps as unintended consequences, which can serve as our next connection. The biggest, most impactful outcomes in history or science sometimes, or typically perhaps, they are beyond quantitative predictions made ahead of time. They are indeed byproducts. And putting byproducts in the context of history suggests unanticipated consequences of human endeavor. They've got a tendency to sometimes be the most potent, widespread, and influential of all, much more than those intended. American history is a great example of that phenomenon at work. Heck, the discovery of America itself by Europeans, that was a surprise and certainly an unintended consequence of trying to find a sea lane to the west of Europe, to places like India, Japan, and China. The bravery, ignorance, and frankly, miscalculation of explorers led to America itself, thus logically showing that if European monarchs, they understood what those unintended consequences of the explorers might be, that they funded, by the way, and they set out to discover would lead to, meaning in the end, lost colonies for those European monarchs, maybe those monarchs never would have sent the explorers to begin with. Boorstin would say that only slaves of ideology dare to box in the future. It's a great phrase. Only slaves of ideology dare to box in the future. And being a slave of ideology, that's anti-American. It's against our national DNA. National pride and the populism of America first, those were byproducts of 13 colonies that couldn't agree on almost anything. The individual rights enjoyed by citizens of the United States, that's the byproduct of human rights abuses and persecutions by others. Manifest destiny and the move westward in our nation's history was in many ways premised upon the unknown and expecting an unintended consequence. We could go on for hours when it comes to Boorstin's writings and teachings, but it is time to wrap this week's installment of The Far Middle. Daniel Boorstin, yeah, impressively multi-talented. So let's talk a final connection to a triple threat talent in a different field, but one that we mentioned earlier, music. The name is Ross Bagdasarian, and that's an Armenian surname, I believe. And I'm pretty sure you don't know that name, but I am confident you know his work and creations, especially when you hear them. But Bagdasarian's first talent was in acting. His Broadway debut was in the late 1930s, and he also appeared in small roles of several iconic films of the 1950s. He was in the war movie Stalag 17, which, by the way, that movie served as the basis for the TV sitcom Hogan's Heroes. They had Stalag 13. And Bagdasarian was also in a movie that was a personal favorite of mine. He had a bit part in the legendary Alfred Hitchcock movie Rear Window. He was the lonely composer at the piano for you Hitchcock fans like myself. His second talent, though, Bagdasarian's, was as a songwriter. He wrote a hit song in the 1950s, co-writing the hit Come On to My House with his cousin, and that became Rosemary Clooney's debut hit song. It's been covered many times through the years. You hear it actually on TV commercials to this day. And by the way, Rosemary Clooney, that's George Clooney's aunt, and she was also the mother-in-law of Debbie Boone. But his third, Bagdasarian's third and most famous talent, it was under his assumed name of David Seville. He experimented with a silly idea of recording his voice and then speeding it up on playback to create a unique sound and to create novelty tunes. That sound became Alvin, as in Alvin and the Chipmunks, which was one of the most profitable franchises, by the way, in the history of music. So Ross Bagdasarian was one of those creator-inventor combo types Daniel Boorstin wrote about, wasn't he? Just an unconventional version. Now give a listen to my favorite Chipmunks album. That would be the Chipmunks Sing the Beatles Hits. Yes, constant listeners, that album actually exists. And until next week, always stay connected to that far middle.